Pure Dog Talk is the voice of purebred dogs. We talk to the legends of the sport and give you the tips and tools to create an awesome life with your purebred dog. From showing to preservation breeding, from competitive obedience to field work, from agility to therapy dogs, and all the fun in between, your passion is our purpose. Welcome to Pure Dog Talk. I'm your host, Laura Reeves. And we are live at the AKC National Championship in Orlando, brought to you by Royal Canin. And I've been running around grabbing as many people as I can find here at the dog show. And I am joined by some very special guests. We have Jackie and Terry Stacy here, longtime members of the Fancy, judges, often pincher breeders, and we're going to have a good talk. So welcome. Thank you.
Our pleasure.
Nice to be here.
Excellent. So tell me, you guys are often pinchers for my knowledge ever. So tell me, give us, we call it the 411. How'd you guys get started with offies?
Well, first I just want to comment that we have been involved with the breed Affin pincher actively for the last 20 years.
Okay.
We, however, with our background in many, many purebred dogs, we established a breeding program with a completely clean slate. No prior biases, prejudices, or whatever. Right. Therefore, we have been able, with the absolute ability of my husband, who I consider a master breeder, that we have been able to advance the breed well, and that the breed now is recognized significantly at the group level and best in show level. And it has remained its same true character, and it is just been a great pleasure to do this.
Yeah. So, Terry, where'd you guys start?
I've been in dogs all of my life, really. I started when I was 13 years old as a junior handler, and I've done something about dogs ever since. I bred my first champions, Cocker Spaniels, in 1955.
Nice.
And I've been involved in breeding really cockers and golden retrievers as far as in breeding program. But I was a professional handler for 15 years, and my last shows were in 1978.
And that's when you started judging?
No, I didn't. First thing I did was I went to work for MBF dog shows. And I had grown up in the area where Tom Crow, who I greatly admired, I thought was, you know, a real innovator. And he actually sought me out and asked me to come and work for him. I did that for about 2 years, but then I was approached by the American Kennel Club, and they were looking for someone who might grow into being in charge of dog events.
Okay.
And I was flattered. Tom Crow was nice enough to back me to do it, and I left, and I went to work for the American Kennel Club. And I did that for 15 years, and I became vice president of dog events. That was my position at the time of the AKC Centennial, which and my staff actually put it on.
Wow.
And that was in 1984.
Yeah.
And I did that. I ended up being senior vice president and left the American Kennel Club in 1994. I then, in 1996, after trying retirement for a couple of years, realized I was too young. Oh, and we started to judge then. We each of us judged a group at that time, and I thought that's what I wanted to do, but I was too young. And I was approached again by the Mars Corporation, and I was in charge of the breeder services program and sponsorship of dog shows for Mars. And we lived in Southern California in Huntington Beach, and I worked in L.A.
Nice.
Then we've retired from there.
You retired again.
And started really judging as a hobby.
Right.
And Jackie and I have enjoyed judging ever since. You know, I now do 5 groups. I don't intend to ever apply again. I'm very happy with the 5 groups that I judge.
Excellent. See, I didn't even know some of this background.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Right. Yeah.
Because, I mean, I got started in dogs in the early 80s, but I was 15. You know, 15, you're not really paying attention to who's in charge of what at the AKC.
Of course, right. Of course, absolutely.
So this is one of the great things about my job. I love my job. I get to talk to the coolest people. So talk to me a little bit about Offen Pinschers specifically. It's a breed I don't know much about. So talk to me like you're educating me, and we'll educate the listeners.
Well, we'll give that a shot. Okay. There you go.
So they're toy group, and they're cute little monkey faces.
Yes.
That's my total experience. Is my friend Tiffany Skinner shows one. That's all I know.
All right. The Offen Pinscher has been around forever.
Okay.
Probably established in the 1700s. There are some art pieces.
Or before, I think 1600s probably.
And they are from their breed?
Germany/France.
Okay.
And they are called the Diabolitan Moustache. So I don't think I'm saying that right.
But, wonderful.
But that is because their character is that they're little devils. And they are a small dog who has an enormous amount of self-importance. And they are German, so they have an enormous amount of stubbornness. But if you can figure out the way to do it, they'll do it for you. But not if you make them do it.
Yes.
So it's a breed that really is comical, and it is a delightful breed to be around. The breed itself, in the past, the dogs were cropped and docked.
Right.
And it was not until about the last 20 years ago in the United States that occasionally we'd see a dog who had ears that were natural and tail that was natural. But it was an occasional thing.
Right.
We had the good fortune of getting our first bitch from Beth Swigert.
Okay.
And I co-owned her with Beth. And she was a wonderful representation of the breed. And she had natural ears and tails. And when now the people looked at it and they saw a different appearance with the tail and ears, it's a softer, impier kind of a look, not as harsh as the dogs that are cut. And as a result, there was an interest in people attempting not to do the cropping and docking.
Interesting.
It is my opinion, I don't know that everyone else shares it, is that rather than spending money, no matter where your position is about cropping and docking, but rather than spending money to make that happen, we much more believe that we are spending our money to do health testing. And so we think that that is far more critical than the cropping and docking, since the standard allows for it both ways.
Standard allows for both ways.
Right, which is way ahead of their time by having that breed standard.
Yes.
And
yes.
As it is now, hardly any dogs are cropped or docked.
Interesting.
Maybe none that you see at shows. We haven't seen a cropped and docked Offen Pinscher up in the last, I don't know, 8 or 10 years. So we feel good. We think we were the people who really started that.
Kind of
Jackie won how many Best in Shows?
I think Marina won 12 Best in Shows.
She won 12 Aubrey Best in Shows, which was a marker.
Right.
And she won the national.
Okay.
And people realized, you know,
that,
and they're monkey-like dogs, their little tails wagging, they're so cute. So that we thought that was a real contribution to purebred dogs, that we kind of changed them to all be natural. And like Jackie said, our prime thing, we like health and longevity, good temperaments are prime, and then we're trying to breed proper type. We bred over 100 champions, and we won the national specialty, I want to say 12 times during that year.
Wow.
I just can't keep those numbers exact, but it's been very good. And we've, I believe, bred 13 dogs who have won Aubrey Best in Shows.
Nice.
So
well, 100 champions, just 100 champions in a breed where you have, what, 2 or 3 in a litter?
Absolutely.
And I mean, that's impressive.
And with a very limited gene pool.
Yeah.
That's the downsize of all of the so-called rare breeds,
right?
Because you have very little to work with, and therefore you have to really be planning your litters. You almost have to make the dog that you want later to be able to be bred to that.
Yes.
And as a result, that has worked really to our advantage.
We haven't personally raised all of those litters. We've been smart, or tried to be smart, and place bitches with breeders.
Good co-ownership homes.
Either we lease it back and are the total breeder, or we're co-breeders in some of the dogs. And, of course, we select the studs and make the picks from the litters and all. So that it's been nice.
I want to follow up on what Jackie was just talking about, that idea of making the dog to have the dog you want to breed to, because it's something that I've done more than once. And it is important when you have these small number breeds.
Absolutely.
So talk to me about an instance. Give me a for instance. You know, I've got this
Well, I guess I'm going to talk about the dogs that are being shown here this weekend.
Sure.
There are several dogs that are of our breeding, either carrying our kennel name, or they are dogs that we have sold the mother and the father to the people, and they may carry their names. Right. But they absolutely have a certain look. Mm-hmm. Everyone says the Tamarin, Affin, Pinschers look the same. Mm-hmm. And that's quite true. Mm-hmm. But when you're doing that, you can't keep breeding onto yourself.
Right.
We know that. So there's a lot of reasons to do that. But this particular weekend, the dog who has won Best to Breed all four of these shows, the three Orlando and today, are all Tamarin dogs.
Okay.
They're two different dogs.
Okay.
One of them is in the classes, and the class dog, we created that mother to be able to be bred to a specific dog, and therefore that is the prodigy.
So you made that bitch, and what were you looking for specifically when you made her? What
all
were you trying to
add?
We really needed to expand our gene pool. We have a very limited gene pool, and it's very difficult because we want to keep our own type that we've done well with. And this particular one, what we bred to a dog that was sired by an English dog that was unrelated to our stock. And the mother only had one cross to one of our best in show producing dogs. Mm-hmm. So it was basically outcross.
A good outcross pedigree.
And the dog that we bred to is a dog that has been a top winner in recent years. And we wanted to breed to him, but we don't inbreed we've never inbred, but we don't even want to line breed so closely.
Right.
And so that we're always looking for new blood. We currently have leased a dog that had been top dog in England. He was really bred in Sweden. We had him for a year, and we have four litters by him during that time. We've kept bitches out of two different litters that will have this total outcross father, no relation in six generations. He looks like the type that we breed, and yet no relation. That was very hard to find.
That's what I'm
spent a lot of money and time to get it.
Like breeding on a phenotype concept instead of a genetic.
Yes, and that will do no harm. The dog has to be typey enough that it can
do no harm. See, therein lies the problem. My mother bred Clumber Spaniels, and she just used to lose her mind. We'd go out to get one thing, and she'd yell. She'd be like, I got 10 things I didn't want.
Well, sure, you know.
But you have to be able to be willing to do that to further your breed to go forward rather than the same old, same old.
Right.
I'd like to comment on that the mother is not a bitch we showed.
Okay.
And probably won't.
Okay.
She's a very attractive bitch, but she is not good enough to represent our typical looking dogs. However, the proof of the pudding is in the get. And that's really what we're speaking to.
Interesting.
Okay? I mean, she's a lovely bitch, but we don't need to make her a champion. There's no reason to.
Yeah. So, my idea in breeding is if you make an outcross for a specific reason, what you get that you think might help you, plus expanding the gene pool, you keep something and then go right back in,
which is what we did here
to get this dog that has won here. Okay. So he really is pretty much line bred, other than his mother was actually bred to be in this program. And now we're going to have the daughters of this Swedish-English dog that we had, and they will go right back into our own line bred studs.
Nice.
And, you know, hopefully it works, you know. And the first generation in the outcross, you almost never get exactly what you want, you know. And you've got to realize that. And I want to keep something out of those breedings that is what might improve our line. And that's what we tried to do.
And it's very interesting. And I'm going to get your take on this and see what you guys think. I was talking to one of my interviews yesterday. Maybe it was Will Alexander. And there's been recent conversations, and this has been fascinating to me. When we as breeders talk about, I am improving the breed. That's why I'm breeding dogs. That's why I want to improve the breed. And then you have the concept of preserving the breed. So are we actually improving the breed, or we're attempting to keep the breed what it was designed to be? Kind of an interesting improving the breed or improving my line to match.
I don't know if Terry will agree with this or not, but from my point of view, I think of this as preservation because I don't think that the dogs really look like the breed standard asks them to look like. So the goal is that we are doing it almost simultaneously, mm-hmm. because those dogs, when we say we want to improve the breed, we want to get the dog to look as close to the breed standard as it possibly can. Not as women of fancy and all these mm-hmm. other things, but really pay close attention to how the dogs are defined by the breed standard. And so each generation or each breeding we do, we're trying to get maybe a better tail set, right. whatever. But right. there you're trying to get a piece of the puzzle. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you're preserving the purpose of the breed. The character of the breed yes. is critical. And then to be able to have dogs that are of high quality.
I like that. That's great.
And we're always thinking, I mean, our breed really, they're kind of hard to get into the world. They're with small litters and... We've had some difficulties that hopefully outcrossing is going to help us getting larger litters and whatever.
Good.
But we're really interested in health mm-hmm. and longevity. And when we make these outcrosses, that's another thing. We try to get a dog that is the type we want, but he has to be health tested like all of our right. stock is. And with that, I would tell you that we have had almost no problems with health.
So what are some of the health issues that the breed runs into?
I don't really would tell you that our own line, we've had outstanding temperaments. I think, some of the other lines that are around have temperament problems.
Sort of like the standard's very clear that the dog is going to be reserved, perhaps, with mm-hmm. the stranger mm-hmm. could mm-hmm. be. But that they fear less, so mm-hmm. they should not be fearful.
Right.
And we do, unfortunately, see some that are fearful, and therefore they are pretty nasty. Mm-hmm. And we certainly mm-hmm. don't want to breed onto that ourselves.
Right.
In general, most of the dogs can live easily way past 15 years of age.
Right, toy breed.
Yes.
Yeah.
But not all toy breeds live that long.
Right.
Okay,
true.
So in this particular case, that's really helpful. And that the health problems, the only thing that was listed in the veterinary mm-hmm. commentary mm-hmm. in the past was mm-hmm. a condition called Legberthes.
Oh, sure.
And the reason I think it was listed was that if a dog had other health-related problems, maybe the owner would say, well, it's okay. It can get around. Everything seems to be fine. Mm. But somebody probably took a dog who was struck with
right.
that condition
right.
to the
right.
vet, and now right. all of a sudden we have something to right. document as a condition right. connected to Afins.
Okay.
But overall, it is quite a
healthy
breed.
Good.
You know, there's like every other breed, some people have had issues, and I guess of cardiac issues.
Mm.
And I always say with cardiac issues, typically is that it is something that's pretty self-eliminating. It's really what it is. So that
yeah.
is, yeah.
yeah.
So that's
yeah.
my view of
yeah.
that.
Slipping patellas is a mm. problem in toy dogs.
Mm.
We have had almost none. Occasionally we have had something born with patella problems, goes as a pet
yeah.
immediately.
Yeah.
Only once have we ever had one where we had surgery done on it to place it as a pet
mm-hmm.
because we need it spayed, neutered,
yeah. right.
never breed them.
Right.
But it is a serious problem in toy dogs and in some lines of Affin pinschers.
Mm-hmm.
We don't breed into those lines mm-hmm. if we know it. You know, I would never breed to a dog that had slip patellas. We have our stud dogs have all been hip x-rayed.
And
wow.
they're checked.
And I was
mm-hmm.
a member of the board of OFA for
mm-hmm.
12 years, and
mm-hmm.
her sister is currently and is still the president of the OFA.
Oh, okay.
However, my personal feeling about hip dysplasia in a little dog like this is that unless it's severe, which it's nothing we've ever had, but I would actually breed a bitch
mm-hmm.
that was mildly affected. That hasn't happened to us very often because we keep conscious of it, and all of our males are tested, and they all have OFA numbers.
Mm-hmm.
We just think it's a good thing to do.
Yes,
know?
Absolutely.
And it keeps us aware of what we're breeding and
mm-hmm.
why we're doing it.
The more information you gather,
well,
the better the decisions can be.
Exactly. Yeah. You can't make good decisions without
yeah.
good information. And we
Correct.
All know the little trope, breeding is part art, part science.
Yes.
You know, and
yeah.
we have to respect both sides of that.
Yeah.
Got it. Right. Absolutely.
Hips can pop up
mm-hmm.
in any...
Yep.
time, I think, but they're never a problem in a breed the size of Affenpinschers like they would be in a large breed.
Oh, wire hair pointer or a Newfoundland or something.
Or even medium-sized dogs. I mean, I come from Cocker Spaniels originally, and we think Cockers ought to have good hips.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Hang tight, guys. Got a little bit of information for you. We'll be right back to the podcast in a minute. So, one of the things that we love here at Pure Dog Talk is your voice. You can leave us a review on iTunes or on the Pure Dog Talk Facebook page. Each episode, I'm going to be sharing one of these reviews on air in the Listener's Voice segment. What a fun way to share the love and show your support for the voice of purebred dogs. Today's listener's voice is from Izzy Lewis, reviewed on Pure Dog Talk in July. Izzy says, as a newbie full of endless questions, Pure Dog Talk is the light at the end of the tunnel. The cast of guest appearances never ceases to impress, and the hosts' combination of rich first-hand experience and big personality, yikes, makes the information shared really hit home as relevant and accessible to every purebred fancier. Thank you so much for sharing this gift with us. Well, thank you, Izzy. I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Okay, so living with them, breeding them, judging them. Talk to us about what are people looking at when they're judging.
Well, I want to just say one thing. They are the most endearing breed I've ever been around. And one of their most marvelous characteristics is they can be, at the same time, your best pet companion and a show dog. Mm-hmm. And many breeds are not that way.
True.
You can't get too close to some of them, and you have to distance yourself or they won't perform. As long as the monkey dog is allowed to act like a monkey, they are absolutely something else. They're portable. They're fabulous.
Good size.
They're
really
just
a
run because they're sturdy little dogs, but they're small. And I think that that is just a remarkable characteristic. And their personalities make you laugh every single day.
They are cute as
hell. They are. They certainly are.
Grooming.
Yes.
I look at that and I'm like, and I do hand stripping. I got nothing. So talk a little bit about how you're making that little monkey face.
Well, in the past, when the breed typically had their ears cropped and their tails docked, they had a very hard look to them. And those dogs oftentimes had hair that was very, very coarse, almost Airedale Terrier kind of texture. And the standard talks about that the hair on the head and the cape and the furnishings, the legs, will be longer and softer.
Interesting.
But that's now. Okay. That isn't what it was then.
Okay.
So with that said, if you are going to show an Affenpinscher in today's world, whether it be at the class level and certainly at the specials level, these dogs must be presented in a way that people who are really skilled can do. It isn't something where you can say, oh, I know how to trim. I've done miniature dachshunds. Okay, it does not apply to the Affenpinscher.
I wouldn't even begin to try it.
And as a result, there's a lot of dogs that are, you know, not presented as well as they could be, and it's going to affect how competitive they probably are against the others.
Right.
But the aspect on the Affenpinscher is it's almost like a oxymoron. They should be shaggy but neat.
Right.
That's almost impossible.
Yeah.
So as a result, many of them now are not shaggy much, but they're very,
very
neat.
Very neat.
And that is an image that has been created by all of the Affenpinscher people within the last, I would say, 20 years. We're part of it, I'm sure. But that is really what it has. But it is an exercise that is difficult because the body of the dog is going to be trimmed shorter, and it has to have multiple layers of hair. So here we're into broken-coated terrier trimming.
You're hand stripping that, right?
Yes. However, if you take too much hair off, particularly at the face, around the face, the head, the eyes, the legs, you're not going to get the hair back. Maybe never. And if you do, it takes forever for it to be full and dense. So it's a quandary for many people.
Yeah.
So your babies, when they're born, they are precious looking fluff balls, basically, until their hair starts to fall out almost on its own, and then they look like a dog who put its foot in the electric socket. I mean, they are really ugly. And then thereafter, once that puppy coat basically can fall out on its own, that's when you can start to try and create the image, is really what you can do. The distinguishing characteristic on the face, and I would like to speak to it, because the most significant feature on the Affenpinscher is its head.
Yes.
Our Parent Club Illustrated Standard has a bullet list on the back of the standard booklet itself, and in the order of priority, it lists the importance of the breed. And the first and foremost one is the head and the face, because a monkey-like expression is paramount. But the distance between the inside corners of the eyes to the end of the nose should be a near equilateral triangle.
Interesting.
So the dog has some length of muzzle. This is, though it's a shorter muzzle, it's not a no muzzle. Mm-hmm. We want
You're not a brachycephalic breed.
Well, I think we're probably sort of.
Not like a Griffon.
We do not want to have this dog have an upturned jaw, and we don't want it to be down-faced.
Right.
And it should be a blunt finish on the muzzle is what it should be, showing a great amount of lower lip line, but it's got to come straight at you. And that lip line combined with the eye placement, combined with the length of muzzle and the ear and where it's placed and how it's used by the dog, are going to give you those characteristics to be the ideal monkey look. And if one's off, it can really skew.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very hard to maintain that look. But we also then, for grooming purposes, you started to ask about that. In order to separate the muzzle from the skull, we end up cutting a upside-down view in the shape of a fan. So you're exposing your eye, so you can see the full part of that, but the height of the fan is right at the bridge of the nose.
Okay.
The stop. Yeah.
One thing that I don't think you touched on was the grooming here. We've really taken the breed, as Americans tend to do, to make
bigger
them
bigger is
pretty.
Better.
Yeah, and the terrier guys all have gotten involved. I believe I would give credit to who I think is one of the greatest trimmers of all time is Peter Green.
Yep.
And I think Peter was really probably the first one that really understood about how you might make one really look pretty.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we can justify that it's shaggy but neat somehow, but not like they used to show them just totally shaggy. Frankly, it's what we like to look at.
Right.
And there have been numbers of the terrier people that have basically followed Peter's lead. And, you know, the dog today looks so different than when we started 20 years ago. And really, that was really when Peter was really getting involved in, in doing this. But before that, I don't think they just didn't look like they look today. They were nice dogs, but they didn't have this kind of grooming. We like it. It's interesting that even in England now, where they refused to think they were ever going to groom them, they're now grooming them. The dog that won Crufts and won the World Show last year was a dog that we personally bred.
Okay.
He's owned by Mick Gatsby, who's a great breeder of lots of breeds there. And was trimmed by an American terrier handler who really knows what she's doing. And, you know, I think it's setting a trend that really the whole world is going to be having them look more like the Americans have them.
Right. Little monkey dogs. Little monkey dogs. And so the last thing I want to close on, mentoring, because I talk to people all the time, and you were mentioning earlier about your co-breeding and some of these. I think it's so important. So talk a little bit about how you guys mentor, what value it has for you, and, you know, pros and cons.
Yeah, we feel that we are always available to mentor someone who's seriously wants to learn about dogs. I am an approved mentor for our parent club, but I had an experience that I did not like, and I refuse to be a ringside mentor now. It was at a national where I was explaining about the breed, just general things like its make and shape. As I would do that in a large class and say, you know, it should be between these two or three, they wouldn't place in the whoever the person that was judging put up other ones. And I don't want to insult or have anything ill to say about my fellow judges. Mm-hmm. And so I don't do that ringside mentoring. It's just something I don't think I can do. But a mentor for someone who sincerely, you know, wants to learn about breeding, somebody who's bought a bitch or something from mm-hmm. us and they want to know how to breed and we help them pick mm-hmm. puppies and right. that sort of thing, I'm always happy to do that.
Right.
I concur with Jerry. I'm not really a believer of ringside mentoring mm. because of the fact that your views, interpretation mm. can be different than the judge before mm-hmm. you. Mm-hmm. So either the student thinks that you are out of your mind or that the judge is maybe out of their mind,
yes.
that I don't think it's necessarily valuable. Mm-hmm. I also don't like to comment about the specific dogs in the ring
right.
because there's too many other ears around besides mm-hmm. a student group.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my personal thing. But when it actually comes to the dogs, the thing I think for us to help people who are aspiring judges,
right.
okay, judges, not breeders, but the judges is, I really like them to come to our home.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like them to see them up close and personal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a matter of going over them. They need to see the whole Affenpinscher.
Right.
You know, that has been a rewarding experience for both of us. And I think for those who have done it, they've mm-hmm. also really mm-hmm. got a better handle.
Right.
That's just
right.
the way I
like
look.
That.
Right?
Right.
The learning curve is terribly steep on any of the rare breeds
mm.
because you don't get enough
don't of them. Don't get enough of them.
And if you're going to get a handful, they're usually a handful from the same people,
right.
so there's not enough to differentiate one
right.
from the other. So I don't think that's a very easy thing for anybody to do. I think that ideally, I mean, I think in theory this is a great idea to have ringside mentoring, but mm-hmm. I don't think it necessarily works. I also feel very, very strongly that people who want knowledge and want you to, you know, say, can you go over a dog or a few dogs or whatever, and then you're going to prove them
mm-hmm.
by signing that form. It means that we think this person should be able to judge
mm-hmm.
that breed. And they got to prove that
okay.
because we take it that seriously.
Right.
We
right.
really want the breed
right.
to be
well,
judged to the breed standard.
Yeah. And this is, listeners, what I was talking to Jackie earlier and we were getting this set up. She said, oh, I'm going to pull out my standard and reread. I'm like, 20 years, you're going to reread. I like that. I mean, I really love that respect for commitment to the breed, commitment to getting it right. And I think that we all can take a lesson from that because I really do think it's that important.
So do we.
We
so
sure
do we. So
yeah.
do we. Yes.
I refer to my standard. I carry an iPad mm-hmm. with all the standards
right.
on it. And
right.
there's probably not a show that I don't, you know,
right.
have something that I need to refer to.
Right.
You just can't remember all the
And the verbiage. And the verbiage. There's a lot of interpretation. And if you use the wrong verbiage when you're discussing this mm-hmm. with an individual, it can mm-hmm. conflict with your breed
mm-hmm.
standard.
And like Terry said, we think probably the newest all breed judge. So how do you remember 190 standards?
You can't.
I mean, you just can't.
You can't.
I'm going to apply for 7 breeds. I'm like, which one is a DQ on this height?
Oh,
and it's terrible.
The good thing is that I'm not sure that the American Kennel Club has this belief, but I think if you know your breed standards overall, been around dogs for a
right.
long time, seen a lot of these kind
right.
of dogs, different breeds of dogs.
Right.
When you look at a dog, you have an idea immediately. Are there DQs in this breed?
Right.
But we have good cheat sheets that help
yes.
us.
Yes.
And therefore, you can quickly identify
yeah.
what are the DQs. But
yeah.
never in a million years would I ever take it upon myself to enforce the disqualification without going right back to my
Absolutely.
Desk, my table,
yeah.
making sure that
right.
I completely understand it
right.
before I even go forward.
Right.
And anybody thinks that they can remember them all.
You can't.
You can't.
No. And we talk about it all the time on this show. Judges were not, A, hatched from eggs.
Yes.
And B, they're trying to do a good job.
Right.
I really think that's important
yeah.
for people to hear.
I'd like to also make comment that I think that one thing that is very helpful, at least it is for me, and I know that it is for Terry, by remaining involved in the sport,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
it keeps you grounded. And I think it makes us better judges
mm-hmm.
because we understand the whole gamut of what it takes to get a dog into the world, what
mm-hmm.
it takes to get it ultimately into the show ring,
mm-hmm.
and all the above. We have a really high respect for fellow breeders
mm-hmm.
and a high respect also for the people just with their commitment to continue to do it. It's costly.
Mm-hmm. It's not cheap.
It's labor intensive, mm-hmm. and you can't be in Afghan pinschers, I'm sure other breeds as well, small litter sizes, neonatal issues. Yeah. That are there, you have to be totally devoted to all of it. So I think by people who criticize judges who are still breeding dogs, I think they are the ones that are wrong, because you can get a little bit omnipotent if you are not involved.
It's good to stay humble.
Yeah. It's humbling. It's very humbling.
Dog breeding will humble you faster than anything I ever heard
of. Oh, my God. I tell you, huh?
It's true.
Oh, Lord.
It is true. All right. Well, I know you guys have lots of dogs to watch. We have lots of beautiful dogs here in Orlando, so we're going to go watch some dogs.
Oh, sure.
Thank you very, very kindly.
Pleasure to be here.
As always, if you have any questions or input, we'd love to hear from you. The show notes and links to resources on today's topic are available at puredogtalk.com. Drop us a note in the comments or email to laura@puredogtalk.com. Remember, guys, this podcast is for you. So if you want to know something, give me a holler. We'll do a podcast for you. If you wouldn't mind, you could help me out here. Take a couple minutes to visit iTunes and give us a review. The Dog Show Superintendents Association is a proud supporter of Pure Dog Talk. Our Dog Show Superintendents are the hardworking people who make the Dog Show function. They are advocates for education and mentorship in the purebred dog fancy. So stop by the Super's desk at your next show. Tell them how much you love Pure Dog Talk and give them a shout out for their support. That's all for today. Thank you for joining us on Pure Dog Talk.